pas. Since George Perkovits is one of our own, I'll be quite brief. When he finished the book, there were two awards that were interesting about the book. One was the Herbert Feiss Award, which described it as the most authoritative and probably most definitive book we're likely to have on India's nuclear bomb, the impact on global proliferation. The subject of nuclear proliferation and the bomb is one which we turn around in and out of our minds and periodically say, well, it's not as relevant, it's not as urgent as it used to be. And it reminded me of one assignment I had when I worked in New York, and I found a passage by a British authority questioning whether we were any longer in the nuclear age. And I brought it into the person in charge, president of the Rockefeller Foundation at that time, and his answer was, I should live so long. Certainly is true. George Perkovits got his bachelor's degree at the University of California, Santa Cruz, his master's degree in, I think, Soviet studies at Harvard University, and his PhD, we're proud to say, at the University of Virginia. He went on from about 1990 to 2001 to serve with an organization known to all of you under the leadership of two people who are members of our Miller Center family, the W. Alton Jones Foundation. And there helped establish this secure society, World Society program with expenditures of in awards and grants totaling $26 million a year. And the making of a nuclear scientist and a scholar in nuclear field and an administrator certainly occurred within the confines of the W. Alton Jones Foundation. And he went on from there to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and has continued to work in this area, but also in national security problems there, writing about the Iraq problem, writing about a whole range of issues in Carnegie Endowment studies and administering, being the second top administrator of their international programs. So we're very fortunate to have this opportunity this morning and a chance to think hard about the question, is the spread of nuclear weapons inevitable, no one is better qualified than George Perkovits to address that.
Well, thank you, Professor Thompson. That was a kind introduction, and it feels like coming home. We haven't actually left. My wife and I and my son, we still live in Charlottesville, but we spend the weeks during the week in Washington. But seeing Jim Turner here, from whom we got our first house when we moved to Charlottesville 14 years ago, and then the Edgertons, of course, with whom I worked for those 12 years that Professor Thompson spoke about, and then, of course, Professor Thompson, who got me through my PhD. So it really is great to be here at the Miller Center. And Bud Branch, who solved all and continues to solve all computer problems, which is perhaps the most important, is more important than a doctor for somebody who writes, is to have somebody that can keep the computer running. So it's great for me to be here. The question that I'm going to address, is nuclear proliferation inevitable, has probably an obvious, correct, and boring answer, which is it depends. I'm going to try to be a little braver than that and say that it depends on what happens in Iran. But before I get to Iran, I want to kind of take you through why it is that I'm relatively optimistic. I mean, I don't think I wouldn't guarantee that we can stop the further proliferation of these weapons, but I don't think it's hopeless or impossible either. The first reason for optimism is historical. That if we're very worried about nuclear proliferation today, and there are very good reasons. I won't go through all of those reasons, but it's been worse. I guess this may happen at any moment in history. You may think it's the worst that it's ever been. And so maybe this is a routine trait, but it has been worse. Where we are today is 8 countries have nuclear weapons. The 5 that we've known about that were allowed to have them under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And then India, Pakistan, and Israel, who have not broken any treaty in acquiring these weapons. They never said they wouldn't get the weapons, and they have them, and it's not really a secret. And we can argue about whether they're threatening or not, and to what degree. But the only outlaw that has nuclear weapons right now, we believe, is North Korea. And then we have Iran, which is in this in-between position, and so we're very worried about. And I will come back to that. But beyond that, there are many fewer nuclear weapon programs today than there were, for example, in the 1980s. In the 1980s, we had South Africa, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Belarus, Brazil, Argentina. They all had secret nuclear weapon programs underway. All of those have been reversed. And then we had the surprise last year of Libya, who had always been on a watch list, which we didn't think was so far along. They came in out of the cold and said, yes, we have this stuff, we're giving it up. So while there are new severe threats that we do have to worry about, if you look at it kind of in an historical perspective, the situation has been worse before. The second reason, I think, for optimism is that the Bush administration has stirred things up. That's an understatement. But we don't know whether it's either for good or for bad, or more good or more bad. But on the issue of nuclear nonproliferation, I would argue that the stirring has been very helpful. We can't say that for certain what the outcome is. But one of the things they did is they got a lot of people's attention, a lot of countries and leaders who tended to do what we'd call free riding. You say, look, this is the greatest power in the world. You guys are trying to run everything anyway. So if there's a problem out there, you solve it. We're not really going to get that involved. They're all aimed at you anyway, so it's your problem. Well, one of the things that happened as a result of the action in Iraq is that a lot of people in the world said, these guys are crazy. And what they've done is now making all of us in danger. It's disordering the world in such a way, if we don't want them to do it again, we better do more. So we can't just sit and watch the U.S. solve all these problems the way that the Secretary of Defense and the Vice President want to solve them. We're going to have to get involved. And so in this kind of paradoxical way, you've got other countries and leaders in other countries saying they got to get out ahead and try to solve these problems. That's all very good. That is a net positive, and I think we can build on that in very important ways. And a third reason I suggest some optimism is because I think you can design a strategy to deal with nuclear proliferation, and it's a strategy that looks like it would work. I can't for the life of me, and I don't know anybody who could design a strategy to make the Congo whole today, to solve problems, for example, in the Congo. And that's tragic. On nuclear proliferation, I think you can at least design a strategy. That doesn't mean you're going to implement it. It doesn't mean it's going to work. But you can do it in a way where you look and you go, yeah, you know, this makes sense. We've got the bases all covered. And so that's one of the things that my colleagues and I at the Carnegie Endowment have been working on for the last year. And we're going to release this in 3 weeks, which is a strategy, it's a draft strategy, to deal with nuclear weapons proliferation in the wake of Iraq and what we know today. And we're releasing it as a draft. It'll look like a very finished, handsome product, but we're releasing it for a draft because we want to invite international debate on it. We're going to travel around the world and go to various capitals and engage people and then refine it based on the feedback we get and then give it to the next administration in Washington in December, whether that's the president reelected or Kerry, and say this is the considered view of American experts but also of the international community that we've been able to engage. And so what I wanted to do this morning is sketch just some of the elements of this strategy. It's a strategy that we call universal compliance. That is not a pretty phrase. It is not artful. But it was the only two words that we could think of that actually describe the reality we're talking about. Universal is very important. What the existing nuclear nonproliferation regime, it's called, it's treaty, is based on states, first of all, but only the states that volunteered to join it. So it left out India, Pakistan, and Israel, for example, that had nuclear weapons and kind of went on without them. That's not necessarily a flaw, but it's a shortcoming. And you can't succeed in this problem without bringing India, Pakistan, and Israel into the process and having them accept obligations of certain kinds of behavior. The other thing that the existing system excludes are non-state actors, corporations that sell stuff, like nuclear technology, individuals who engage in black marketeering of nuclear technology and materials. They don't violate laws necessarily. It's not illegal to do a lot of what we've been reading about that Pakistanis and others were providing to Libya and Iran. It doesn't necessarily break international law or national law. So what we need to affect to begin with is a universal framework of rules to then say, okay, everybody's got to have obligations, and we ought to have the writ to enforce these obligations on everybody. No exclusions. And so that's the first half of universal. Second is compliance, which again should be obvious. You have rules, you want people to comply with them. But for the last 30 or 40 years, we've tended to focus, and not just the US, but people have tended to focus on getting folks to sign treaties and pay less attention to whether they actually complied with them. And this, to the credit of the Bush administration, was what they focused on. So the hawks in the administration came in and said, treaties are worthless because people don't comply with them. Well, they got it half right. Treaties aren't worthless, but they're only worthwhile if people do comply. So they threw out the treaties because people weren't complying with them. What we're saying is, no, don't throw out the treaties. In fact, because this problem is universal, you need more rules. But then you're right. You do have to figure out how to emphasize and bring compliance. And so in the strategy we're devising, we kind of list five major obligations to which everyone needs to comply. And I'm going to go through them briefly, but implicit in what I've just said about the administration and their approach to treaties is, you know, we can design a strategy, you can design and list obligations and rules, but the trick is to make other people comply with them. And this, again, is why we emphasize universality. The current approach, and this has always been the U.S. approach, but it's been more dramatic in the last couple of years, has been basically to say to everybody, do as we tell you, and we'll do as we want. And the problem with that is it works if all problems can be solved through coercion. And coercion in terms of military force, economic power, you know, political pressure. That'll work. You can impose an unfair set of obligations, a kind of bifurcated system, if you have enough power and if the problem is a certain kind of problem. It turns out it doesn't work when dealing with nuclear proliferation, because what you need is a lot of cooperation from other people who can withhold that cooperation if you don't make it worth their while. And you can't threaten them sufficiently to make them cooperate. So you have to deal with them. You have to come up with bargains. You have to make them feel that the rules that you're trying to get them to enforce don't just advantage the already strong, but also will advantage people that are less well off. You have to make non-proliferation serve not just the countries with nuclear weapons, but also the countries that don't have them. And that's been one of the failings of the way that we've done this in recent years. And it's not been just protecting U.S., for example, military supremacy and our own nuclear supremacy. So saying to other people, you guys don't have nuclear weapons. Everybody else help us interdict and board ships and stop acquisition of nuclear weapons. But we're going to develop some new nuclear weapons here, but it extends further so that Israel's nuclear weapons goes unremarked upon by the U.S. while we're going to Iran and others and saying, you know, we'll invade you if you acquire nuclear weapons. And so there's a bigger structural problem of how do you maintain a system where eight countries are okay to have nuclear weapons, but nobody else can have them, and this is going to be the case in perpetuity. It's a fundamental instability. It's a structural flaw in the system. And so what we're saying is we have to recognize that and move towards a universal system. The first obligation is to reaffirm that the states that don't have nuclear weapons need to reaffirm that they're not going to acquire them. And here we have to define it better than it was defined in past years. And we have to explicitly make clear that acquisition of facilities to enrich uranium and separate plutonium, which is the way that you get the two main ingredients for nuclear weapons, that no one else can acquire these capabilities. The problem we have, for example, in Iran, which we'll come to, is that under current rules, it's okay for you, for Iran, to acquire plants to enrich uranium. What the system says is you just have to let us inspect the plant and promise that you won't use it for nuclear weapons. Where we are today is that that's not good enough. It's too dangerous to allow countries to get these facilities and then rely on our capacity to inspect and make sure that they're not diverting material or that they don't have a secret plant. They're not ordering four parts, putting two in the facility we go to and two in a cave someplace for a secret facility. It's too dangerous. We have to change those rules. The president has recognized this and called similarly for the change. But the question is, how do you make a bargain so that others say, okay, we'll give up what has been our right to acquire these facilities, but we have to get something in return. And that's where the U.S. thus far has come short. In our strategy, we offer some things that can flesh out a potential bargain. Second clear obligation is that we have to secure all nuclear materials. That is that all states must maintain robust standards and mechanisms for securing, monitoring, and accounting for all fissile materials in any form. Okay, that's a mouthful. Right now, there's thousands of tons of plutonium and highly enriched uranium around the world. A lot of it, most of it's in Russia. There are no international standards for securing that material. There is much better security on gold than there is on nuclear bomb material. And yet what we're worried about are terrorists who can't hurt us with gold, but can destroy cities with these nuclear materials. So we have to raise the standards, first of all, under which these materials are stored, and then make sure that those standards are lived up to and implemented. This hasn't been done yet, surprisingly enough. And so we propose in our strategy a mechanism for doing it where the heads of state of all countries that have these materials, and there's about 15 or 16 countries that are key, that we're saying they should designate special envoys reporting directly to them to go off someplace and commit within a year to devising the standards and putting up the resources to make sure that every country that has these materials has the resources to secure them up to the state-of-the-art standard. What tends to happen is rulemaking on this kind of issue usually takes 20 years, and it's done by a bureaucrat that nobody's ever heard of. The president never knows that it's even happening, and then is surprised to learn that we don't have better security in these things. So what we're saying is recognize how severe the problem is. This is the greatest threat to us, nuclear terrorism. So have the heads of state appoint somebody who reports directly back to them. So the president's accountable, the prime ministers are accountable, and say go off and cut through the underbrush and figure out how we're going to secure these things. A related step that we know has to be undertaken is there's lots of highly enriched uranium sitting around in basically stranded nuclear reactors in Uzbekistan, Congo. There was some in Serbia during the Kosovo War, and Ted Turner paid to take it away because the U.S. government couldn't or wouldn't do it. So Ted said, the hell with it, I'll do it, and basically wrote a check and then got U.S. military people to come get the material. With the IAEA. There, in 35 countries, this stuff is just sitting around. It was a result of the Atoms for Peace program, where we were trying to get everybody to use nuclear energy, to build nuclear reactors, to buy Westinghouse and GE. And so to give them encouragements, we would set up research reactors, small reactors in lots of countries, and then provide them with highly enriched uranium to fuel the reactors. Well, then inevitably, they, you know, people lose interest, country has a revolution, there's coups, whatever. The material's still there. And sometimes it doesn't even have a fence around it. And you can find out where it is on the internet. So if we're worried about terrorists, we've got to go and get this stuff and clean it up. And so that has to be a very high priority. Third big category of obligation is to stop illegal transfers of materials, know-how, equipment. This is obvious enough. I referred to it earlier. But existing international and national law wasn't set up to actually do that. There was progress in April that barely got reported in the U.S., but the U.N. Security Council did agree on a resolution, Resolution 1540, which for the first time required all states to establish export control laws and other laws to criminalize the trafficking in weapons of mass destruction materials. This had never been done. You can say, okay, UN Security Council resolution, there are lots of them, who cares, nobody lives up to them. This one, all of which is a problem, but this one is done under Chapter 7 of the UN, which makes it mandatory for states and also means that if you don't comply, and if we or somebody goes and finds that you didn't develop these laws and enforce them, that under Chapter 7, the international community has the right to use any means necessary, including force, to bring you into compliance with this resolution. So it does have bite, and it does signify this recognition that this problem of making illegal this illicit transfer has to be undertaken. Fourth big obligation is we have to devalue the political and military currency of nuclear weapons. Simple enough, except that we haven't done it. So, for example, since 1968, when the Non-Proliferation Treaty was first negotiated, the sine qua non of kind of showing that you were devaluing nuclear weapons and we were trying to reverse the arms race was a comprehensive test ban. Stop testing these things. And every U.S. president from Eisenhower subscribed to this, advocated the test ban. It was finally negotiated in 1996 and agreed. It took more than 30 years. Except the Senate in 1999 refused to ratify it in the United States. So there is no in-place comprehensive test ban treaty. And for the rest of the world, this demonstrates that the U.S. has no intention of living up to its commitment to devalue nuclear weapons. And so it's breaking its part of the bargain that was the core non-proliferation bargain. So that's a clear step that the U.S. has to take in this direction, and then to ensure that others follow. But related to it, we have to stop developing new nuclear weapons. So believe it or not, we're in a situation now where we're trying to get everybody else to forego nuclear weapons. We say nuclear weapons, in essence, are murderous devices. Iran's evil because it's trying to acquire them. Saddam Hussein's threat was trying to acquire nuclear weapons. And oh yeah, we're going to develop a whole new generation of better, more usable nuclear weapons. And that's the argument for them, is that these will be more usable nuclear weapons that our labs are trying to develop, that the Congress just funded in the last couple of months. There had been a congressional block on funding work on new nuclear weapons. Tom DeLay and the majority in the House overrode that. So we are now funding the development of new nuclear weapons in the United States at the same time as we're trying to make these weapons anathema every place else in the world. And that, and also that we're trying to say these are unusable weapons. It's evil to use these weapons, but the slogan behind the new ones we're developing is they're more usable. So figure it out. Going further on this whole question of living up to the obligation to devalue these things, one of the things we call for is we don't know if it's even feasible to eliminate all nuclear weapons. We are committed by treaty and political pledges in 2000, in 1995, and 1968 to eliminate our nuclear arsenals. But nobody has ever actually figured out how you would do it. And so what we call for is the state, all the states that have nuclear weapons, to develop, prepare white papers detailing what their plans would be and what their technical requirements would be to actually eliminate these weapons in such a way that when you had them all broken down, the materials would be secure, they could be verified, and in the process of allowing verification, you wouldn't give away secrets of how you built them that other people could use. It's an extremely complicated process. Only the United Kingdom has even begun to do the analytical work to say this is what it would take if we were to live up to our commitment. So the rest of the world has a reason to say, well, how serious are you about the commitment if you haven't even tasked one person in the entire U.S. government to start saying, well, here's what it would take to live up to it? And we're saying we ought to demand this of Israel, of India, and Pakistan, that everybody has to lay out this roadmap of technically what it would take. Our own guess is that once you lay that out and when you realize that you can't afford to have 5 kilograms of plutonium go astray in the entire world, that you're going to conclude, well, maybe we can't get to zero. That maybe it's just technically infeasible, the risks are too high, the costs are too great. In which case, we ought to go look back at the original bargain where we promised to go to zero and say, actually with the integrity of having really looked at it rather than of pretending to have looked at it, and say, okay, look, we've got a problem. We realize we owe you. We've got a bargain here. This is supposed to be a fair agreement. But look, we've detailed what it would take, and nobody wants to live in the world where you'd have this kind of intrusive verification. You couldn't have nuclear power. You don't want to live in that world. We don't think we can afford to live in that world. So what is it we do to keep this bargain intact, given that we've now discovered and we've taken seriously how difficult it is? So this is the kind of one of the major innovations in the strategy that we're calling for. Let me close with Iran and why I think Iran is so pivotal. And it points to the fifth element of the strategy, which is to really focus on the regional security conflicts that are driving proliferation in many ways. Iran is so pivotal because, in my view, precisely because it's been caught. All right? North Korea basically broke into the store, they stole the TV, they've gone, they're out of the country, they're watching the TV, you're not going to go get it back, in all likelihood, all right? With Iran, we happened to get lucky. We saw them break the window, and the cop pulled up and said, freeze. They don't have the TV. They're not even in the store. They broke the window. And the cops got them and saying, freeze. And so the question is, do they laugh, pull the TV out, and walk away? In which case, the cops aren't worth much and the laws aren't worth much. And it's going to be hard to stop other people from doing that if they've seen what these guys got away with. Or are we going to, having caught them, are we going to see it through? All right? They get away from the store. They make restitution. And we go forward. And that's where we are with North Korea. And so if they get away with it, I think it's going to be very hard to prevent others from taking similar steps. The Security Council will be shown to be hollow and feckless. The European Union, which is negotiating with them, will shown to have been ineffective. So the question then is what to do. There are a number of universal rules that are being discussed that can help deal with North Korea. I won't detail them here, but for example, it should be possible tomorrow to declare that a state that is in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, as North Korea is, cannot violate the treaty and then withdraw from it with impunity, which is currently the illusion that some countries are under. They say, well, we just get the uranium while we're under the treaty, get right up to the edge of getting a bomb, and say, hey, we withdraw from the treaty, now we have the bomb, you can't do anything about us. That all has to be clarified through international law and the UN Security Council. There are other steps related to that. But more specifically, in dealing with Iran, the U.S. has rightly, I believe, encouraged France, Britain, and Germany to take the lead in negotiating with Iran, trying to walk Iran back. Iran agreed with these states to suspend its uranium enrichment and other fuel cycle activities. But the problem has been is that we haven't defined suspension. And so as good negotiators, the Iranians keep doing stuff saying, well, that isn't what we had in mind with suspension. And then the EU and we say, no. That's, you can't keep importing parts for centrifuges. That's not part of suspension. They said, well, you never said that. And so we need to clarify what the terms are. And the European Union has to do that. They had given it to the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy, to make that definition. They need to take that back. The U.S. needs to encourage this. The problem with the EU and the U.S. is that half of the U.S. administration wants the EU to fail because they want to say, I told you so, you can't negotiate with people. The only way to do it is to do what we did in Iraq. The other half of the administration wants the EU to fail because we can't fight another war. But the administration hasn't agreed because they're at a stalemate within the administration. They haven't agreed to make clear to the Europeans, yes, you could make a deal with the Iranians and we would back the deal. And the deal would involve the Iranians agreeing not to acquire these facilities that concern us in return for guaranteed supply by Russia of fuel for Iranian nuclear reactors. Russia and Iran have a deal. They're almost done with the reactor. The U.S. still opposes the completion of the reactor and the supply of the fuel by Russia. We need to convey to the Europeans, we'll back that deal, go ahead. Because the Iranians right now, when the Europeans come and say, if you talk to the Americans, because you Europeans are telling us this is the deal, but the Americans are saying it's not the deal, and they're the ones that tend to worry us. So get in alignment on it. And we haven't gotten in alignment, and we have to. Now, one of the reasons we haven't gotten in alignment, and this is another policy change, is we want a lot of things from Iran. We want them to stop supporting terrorism. You can define that in lots of different ways. We want them to stop interfering with the Middle East peace process, which doesn't exist anymore. We want them to improve their human rights practices. And we also, obviously, want them to stop their nuclear program. Now, the problem is we want it all as far as the Iranians are concerned, and they sit there and go, well, is it realistic that we're going to give you everything you want tomorrow, like in just one big present, and then we're going to see what you do in return? We fail to kind of bargain and parse this issue. And it seems to me objectively true that the most important thing is Iran's nuclear program. The most important thing to stop is their acquisition of nuclear weapons. The peace process, fine, but it doesn't exist anyway. So what is it that we're trying to get them to do that is going to determine the fate of the peace process that's more important than what the Israelis or the Palestinians are doing? Well, there's nothing. You can go down the list. The thing that matters the most is nuclear weapons. And so we ought to clarify that to the Iranians and say, if you stop this nuclear program, we will start doing some of the things that you want from us. Unfreeze the assets we froze in 1979. Encourage the EU to begin economic engagement. Welcome you into the World Trade Organization. That's the only country we're trying to keep out of the WTO, is Iran. There are a number of steps that we can do that would signify to the Iranians that that you can do business with the U.S., and we ought to make them focused on the nuclear issue and not hold it up on everything else we want from Iran. Now, some in Washington say, well, you can't do that. You can't deal with this current government in Iran because they're evil. So don't deal with them. Just squeeze the hell out of them and hope they collapse like the Soviet Union did. The response to that, it seems to me, that the president has to clarify, because it's half the people in his administration are saying that, is, first of all, we don't have the time. Iran could get nuclear weapons in a couple of years. We don't know how long regime change would take. So if you're waiting for regime change, you may wait right past the time when they get nuclear weapons, which doesn't make sense. And secondly, with the Soviet Union, we did both. We negotiated arms control. We negotiated with the Soviet Union for decades at the same time as we were saying and doing what we could politically to strengthen reform and to highlight the abuses of the Soviet government. Ronald Reagan went and said, tear down this wall, at the same time he was negotiating a treaty to eliminate all medium-range missiles from Europe. You can do both. It's only this administration that thinks that you can't, or parts of this administration. And so the idea that we'll be selling out reformers in Iran if we negotiate to deal with their nuclear weapon program has to be corrected first and foremost. And then lastly, or second to lastly, we need to persuade the other members of the Security Council, France, Britain, Russia, and China, to convey privately to the Iranians that we don't want to take them to the Security Council. Iran wants to avoid being brought into the Security Council. We need to convey privately we don't want to take them to the Security Council, but if they don't do what the EU is demanding of them, we have the votes, and we will take them to the Security Council. This is different from the administration's strategy, or again, half the administration's strategy, which is they want to bring the Iranians to the Security Council 6 months ago. But when you ask them what would happen in the Security Council, they say, we don't know. Do you have the votes for sanctions? No. What do you think Iran would do in reaction? We don't know. And so rather than kind of make this point of blowing up the whole thing by going to the Security Council, use the leverage of Iran's desire not to go to the Security Council to say privately, if we got there, we'd have the votes, but we don't want to get there, so do these things that we're asking. And then lastly, and it circles back to some of the other stuff I said, as a political matter, we can't convince Iran, which has very vibrant politics, to give up its nuclear program without dealing with broader problems in the Middle East, including Israel's possession of nuclear weapons. The point is not that Israel's nuclear weapons threaten Iran, or that Israel is going to attack Iran. That is not the point. The point is that in Iranian politics, which, as I say, are very vibrant, the idea of great Persian civilization being denied these weapons that the Israelis have and are tolerated, condoned, that double standard becomes politically very, very difficult to sell in Iran. The point is not that Israel can or should give up its nuclear weapons in the near term or without, you know, peace with its neighbors. The point is you got to acknowledge this is a problem, which we have not acknowledged, and then work toward a process for addressing it. So at least in Iranian politics, the outrage that we don't even acknowledge it's a problem has been eliminated. And we can put the onus back on the Iranians and say, if you don't recognize this country's right to exist, how can you expect it to give up a strategic deterrent, which is the current case? So the onus would go to Iran and others to recognize Israel's existence as part of the process to then deal with those weapons. Let me stop there and take questions. Thanks.
Who would like to begin the discussion?
I speak as a retired professor of physics, and my profession was nuclear physicist, as a matter of fact, and I have a number of comments to make. I think you've addressed the political aspects of this problem beautifully, and I want to thank you for that. But my comments, I'm not as sanguine as you are about this, I'm sorry to say, from my perspective. And I would say that the answer to your original question as whether nuclear weapons will continue to proliferate is definitely yes. And I will say the reason for that is severalfold. First of all, technology does not stand still. When the method for separating uranium was gas diffusion, which was a gigantic thing that you couldn't hide and so on and so forth, and only a couple countries could afford, that was one thing. But now we have, of course, gas centrifuges, which are much smaller and much cheaper. But those are now all essentially obsolete. There are methods of separating uranium and isotopes in general using lasers that will become more widespread and cheaper, and they're very small. And what they mean, among other things, is that you don't need fancy ores either. Uranium is a very widespread element. It's one of the commonest minerals on the face of the earth. So that people do not need to get their ore from high-quality uranium ores and so on. They can separate stuff from crappy low-grade ores. That's the first thing. So it won't be so easy to contain the materials. The second thing is that small countries really don't trust, and the reason is that they have no reason to trust either the U.S. or the U.N., because neither one of them has in the past proved trustworthy for small nations' interests. So a small nation that is feeling paranoid and feels its only chance at parity is to have a nuclear weapon is surely not going to necessarily want to give it up, except, you know, what guarantees can we offer them exactly? It's not so easy, especially based on our past behavior. The third thing I would say is that if I were a terrorist and I wanted a nuclear weapon, I would get one from the many stockpiles that exist now. In Norfolk, for example, on the ships, they got nuclear weapons that can be fired through ships' guns and so on. I mean, that means they're pretty small. If I were a clever terrorist, I would arrange to bribe somebody and put a dummy in its place in the rack of nuclear warheads, you know, shells. And it's probably much easier than trying to develop your own, plus it comes with an underwriter's laboratory guarantee of that it will work, which your own doesn't necessarily do without testing. And the last thing is a long-term thing. You know, all this stuff about the reason the Middle East is important right now is because of oil and because of the crucial nature of oil to the world economy and the world energy supply. But oil is running out. It's guaranteed to run out. It's not a limitless supply, and the only thing that I see as a viable alternative is nuclear power. Okay? We don't know how to make fusion power. We do know how to make nuclear power plants. They're cheap, they're efficient, and they don't pollute either. And I think one of the things that's been holding us back from a nuclear economy, and it's not holding Europe really back from a nuclear economy, is the fact that people have been worried about proliferation, trying to think of a way to set up a reasonably safe nuclear power economy. But when oil goes and you have to have nuclear power plants anywhere, how are you going to control this? That's why I think that the spread of nuclear weapons is inevitable. I mean, the knowledge is known. It's easy to make them. That's the real problem. They're not. I had a friend once who tried to design, for the purposes of a thriller novel, a nuclear weapon that would not work. And he was told, and he'd never been in the nuclear business, you know, the weapons design business, but he was told by somebody who was, why the hell did you do that? That will work. So it's
should we take a couple at a time and then respond?
Right. Anyway, I'm sorry my comments were so long, but that's basically what I have to say.
Let me take two and then we'll...
All right, second one. Yes, Mr. Williams. Briefly, if possible.
You mentioned Ted Turner's effort in buying nuclear material. Could you comment on the I understand Sam Nunn is involved in that effort. It's been going on for some years. Could you comment on the value of that effort and the success of the effort so far?
Okay, let me start there and work back. Ted Turner started what's called the Nuclear Threat Initiative, and Sam Nunn is running it daily. And basically what it's focused on is, as we did the Jones Foundation, trying to reduce and eliminate the dangers posed by nuclear weapons. What they focused on mostly is securing materials and working in the former, with Russia and former Soviet states, where most of the materials are, to improve security, destroy more weapons, and then also to cooperate to reduce the alert rates. Our weapons and Russia's weapons, thousands of them, are still on hair trigger alert. In other words, they're ready to go within like 10 minutes. This Senator Nunn was always disturbed by this, but says, wait a minute, what is the conflict we have with Russia where we need to be able to destroy each other in the next 10 minutes? And yet we also, you know, it's possible for terrorists or others to hack the computers we're worried about in Russia to launch those weapons that are on alert. So they're working collaboratively with Russian and American generals to try to deal with that problem as well. And so the thing in Yugoslavia was just part of the spirit of this venture was they're focused on nuclear materials. They found out the stuff was in, I think it was 38 kilograms of highly enriched uranium was in Serbia, and the U.S. government couldn't get it out because of some congressional restriction. And so Ted said, hell, I'll do it. And in Nunn, using his connections, got the government to cooperate. So I think it's a very useful venture, and they're still at it. On these other questions, there are a bunch more. Technology doesn't stand still. It's true. It's easier to enrich uranium than it used to be. I think you have to focus on the demand side. The problem appears a lot more manageable. There are 200 countries in the world. 8 have nuclear weapons. And there's a couple other we're worried about that might want to get them. That's a pretty good record. These weapons aren't appealing to a lot of countries. They're not appealing to a vast majority of countries. And there are more things we can do on the demand side, even if the technology gets easier to acquire. It's true, small countries don't live on trust. Well, there have always been small countries. Small countries with nuclear weapons generally conclude they won't be more secure either, because if they're worried about big countries, small countries with small numbers of nuclear weapons aren't going to be that much better off facing big countries. And the transition of getting from zero to a few nuclear weapons can be very dangerous. And so I think there's still some reason for optimism on the demand side. On the Middle East, and this is an important issue right now, especially with the price of oil. Oil isn't the only reason we're very interested in the Middle East, and oil isn't the reason that has many people, our enemies, agitated at us. We would be interested in the Middle East because of Israel, regardless of whether there was any oil there. And this tends to be overlooked. And one of the reasons politically we're so interested is the evangelical Christian movement, with 24 million voters, has this as one of their highest priorities, which is one of the reasons why the president does what he does. It's not a Jewish lobby or anything like that. It's an evangelical Christian movement, which has nothing to do with oil. All right, it has to do with the need of Israel to acquire all of the lands of Judea and Samaria so that the Messiah will come again. Okay? And so if we all switch our oil policy, that problem doesn't go away. And it's a problem that's not spoken about in American politics. If you want to read something that is the most important article I've read in years, in the current issue of The New Yorker, Jeffrey Greenberg, who's an Israeli journalist and Army veteran, has a very long article on the settler movement in Israel. I don't know what the right word is, but it'll curl your hair. You'll be shocked. It is a truly moving, profound article that deals with this, and I think everybody should read it. He just goes out and basically is interviewing leaders of the settler movement, and then he is interviewing the army chief and just describing what it is they want, the settlers, their attitude towards the land, towards the Palestinians, the army's attitude towards having to protect the settlers, which the army doesn't really like to do because it causes so much difficulty for them. Talks to politicians about why the settlers, who are basically 2% of the country, are driving everything in Israeli politics. But it's basically interviews. He just goes out and amongst people, I don't want to give away in a sense a lot of it, but it'll just there's been nothing like it in the American press.
Okay, next, Dr. Cooper.
I hate to pile on, but since you're a local person, you're not a guest from outside of state or another city, I think it's in-house. In listening to a presentation carefully, I just did not identify much that sounded like more than rule-tightening, some improved enforcement of rules, nothing really substantial. It sort of sounds like something a congressional committee would come up with in trying to improve some security issue. Some very big issues are glossed over. I mean, to flesh out, for example, you use the phrase flesh out how we can motivate other countries to not want to have nuclear weapons or other individuals. I mean, what kind of fleshing out are we talking about? From my point of view, it strikes me that maybe ultimately, and I don't think nuclear war is inevitable by any stretch. I think it's highly, highly unlikely. My question is, have you got something that'll make it less inevitable? What of all of your program, what are the two or three items you think are the most useful? And could we live maybe with the threat that there will be isolated nuclear weapons produced by renegade forces that we may just have to live with the fact that they could be detonated, and focus perhaps on the mutual destruction issue that we still have? Sorry for the long
comment. It's funny because I'm sympathetic to the thing where it's just kind of incremental rule tightening and stuff. We sent drafts of what we're doing around to leading officials in the U.S., Israel, France, Russia, China, and so on. They all said it was way too radical. You'll never get 90% of this done. I'm sympathetic to your view, but there we are. I mean, just as an example, the test ban, in terms of symbolic politics and reducing demand, the test ban is like kindergarten. And we can't get that through the United States. So that's part of the challenge, and we're trying to figure out, okay, how can you make progress on that? I think similarly, you said, what are the most important things? Well, I mean, make the point of not developing a new generation of nuclear weapons, for example, would be a fairly big message to send. The scooping up these materials that I talked about, which we ought to be able to do in 2 years, these loose materials, highly enriched uranium and others around the world, it's a non-trivial exercise, although it won't cost that much, but it would do a lot to deal with the terrorism problem. That's doable, hasn't been done. I know El Baradei, the leader of the IAEA, was in the White House last month, mentioned this to the president, and the president said, turned to the Secretary of Energy and says, don't we have anything to deal with that? And the Secretary of Energy turned to one of his aides and says, don't we have anything to deal with that? And the aide says, I think we do. All right, and so that's an example. So we're trying to elevate that. I believe that some of these rule changes that we're talking about, which would have to go on Security Council resolutions, it seems bureaucratic and everything else, but there is no miracle cure. The only shortcut on this is the use of force. I mean, it really is the only shortcut. Dr. Edgerton said, I mean, it's like surgery. That's the analogy to surgery. One option would be years of psychotherapy versus surgery. And where surgery is appropriate, we ought to do it. We thought it was appropriate in Iraq. Maybe it was. Maybe it wasn't. We can't do it anymore. Our army can't fight anyplace else. They won't. Doesn't exist. We're pulling them out of South Korea, even though we're worried about a conflict there. So that surgery just got a lot harder. So unfortunately, we're into psychotherapy, dieting, exercise, and I would love for it to be otherwise, but I don't think that it is. Unfortunately, I wish it were otherwise.
Since you're dealing with this, was there a debate about invoking Chapter 7 of all the parts of the Charter that hasn't been implemented? That seems to be the foremost. Peacekeeping is so much easier than peacemaking. Everything about Chapter 7, there's no security, there are no security forces to administer it. But you must have had a reason for centering on that.
Well, the resolution we talked about, which deals with these strengthening export controls, the U.S. insisted that it be under Chapter 7 to give it more muscle, and so to convey that the Security Council was prepared to endorse the use of force. And what was interesting is that the other members went along with it. Which was part of what I'm saying is after Iraq, the people are more serious about trying to prevent this from happening again, and I think that's the thing that has to be built upon. And there's in Washington, it's hard to describe the feeling in Washington right now about how disastrous Iraq is, and that's without recrimination for how we got there. But people are learning a lot of lessons from it, and so there's more and more interest, for example, in a permanent capacity in the UN to deal with peacekeeping, for example, where the U.S. would always have opposed that. Now we're talking about, okay, we're prepared to train people and provide assets for a permanent capacity in the UN to do that. That was unheard of before, but when you've got guys getting shot up in ways that you never thought was going to happen in a war you thought was going to be a cakewalk, and then you've got other hot spots around, and you don't have enough people in Afghanistan, it tends to focus the mind. And so some of this kind of actually giving some robustness to institutions that we have ignored for years, that's starting to happen, again, as an unintended consequence. But I would argue a positive consequence of what's happening in Iraq.
These are two questions from the outside room. I don't know whether either one of them is worthy of your attention.
I don't have an answer worthy of the question. One of them is, do I understand your solution vis-a-vis North Korea is isolation, and where does that leave the non-state terrorist problem? I don't have a solution in North Korea. That's why I didn't talk about it. Maybe Pat does, but North Korea is a right now. North Korea is waiting for the U.S. election to happen, and the U.S. is waiting for the U.S. election to happen. All right, so nothing's going to happen. The North Koreans are hoping they can get somebody better to deal with, and the U.S. is basically saying, we got so many messes, we don't want another one, so we're not going to say anything to ruffle the North Koreans' feathers. I think the only way out of this is both a direct U.S. dialogue with the North Koreans, which we've been avoiding, but also the regional dialogue so that the U.S. isn't alone, and so that it's conveyed to the North Koreans that their other neighbors are with us on this. But that isn't rocket science. I mean, ultimately, you're going to have to pay these people off, I think. And that's very unappealing, and it's one of the reasons for years the administration didn't have a North Korea policy, because the North Koreans are very impolite, and you wouldn't bring them home to dinner, and you don't want to negotiate with them. And so the president basically said, I'm not going to deal with these people, which is fine, except they have ways of making trouble so that you ultimately do have to deal with them. It's a very unappealing prospect. But if you're not prepared to go to war, which we aren't because we're occupied someplace else, then you don't have much of an alternative at the moment. The non-state terrorist problem, again, I come back to the key to deal with the terrorist problem is to secure these materials. All right, the materials that exist now, these guys can't, even though the technology is getting easier, we don't believe there's terrorist organizations that can produce this material on their own.
I was thinking of small states.
Yeah, no, I know you are. That's what I'm saying. I'm using you as a reference to, in a sense, that even the small states may be able to do this. Terrorist organizations we don't think can. So you got to secure the material that's there. That's the key way to deal with the terrorist problem. I was in SAC, Strategic Air Command. Why can't we run our nuclear program like General LeMay did? Well, General LeMay was crazy. General LeMay wanted to preemptively destroy the Soviet Union with nuclear weapons when we had the monopoly. That was his proposal. Let's just go get it over once and for all. General LeMay also said that if we have a nuclear war and it's left to there's two Americans and one Russian on Earth, we won. Unfortunately, we have leadership that's better. And in fact, the Ted Turner project that we mentioned, General Hobbiger, who was the commander of all U.S. nuclear weapons, he retired about 6 or 7 years ago. He's on the board there and is leading the work with the Russian generals. So these are both groups that have commanded all their nuclear weapons to try to figure out how to take them off of alert, precisely because they're very worried about that. I don't think that preemptive destruction of other countries is a viable solution to this problem, even if it worked physically, because the U.S. just can't do that and maintain its position in the world.
We've come to our normal adjournment time. If nothing else, what you certainly have done, it seems to me, is to remind us that we can't stop thinking about this problem, and that's what your strategy plan undertakes to do. And so many people have given up, and people in highly placed positions in various administrations. And Kissinger, for instance, has made statements to that effect. So you're challenging us to realize that something has to be undertaken and thought about, at least. And you've helped us to do that this morning. So thank you very much.
Thank you.